The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guest on Off the Shelf is Tom Davis. Tom is the Director of Federal Government Affairs for Deloitte and is my former congressman, or the former congressman from the 11th District here in Virginia. Tom, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here.
Well, I'm looking forward to this conversation. It's always fascinating stuff when you come on the show and talk politics. But first, I have to ask you about the Nats. Have you been to any games yet? And how do they look?
I was there for the 16 inner. I was there Friday night. I've been to the majority of the games this year. And it's a really exciting team. The difficulty for me is I got hockey tickets, too, and you had games the same night.
So all right, absolutely.
Some days I've been to both games, but sometimes they're at the same. But this is an exciting time to be a sports fan in Washington.
That day would be a sports extravaganza if you could go to the baseball game in the afternoon and the hockey game at
night.
I
did that
night.
Opening day.
Excellent.
Absolutely, and I've done it twice. You know, and I hope more to come because I think we got more hockey games coming
absolutely. Just knocked off the Flyers, so we're on to the next round. Anyway, we're here. Well, enough sports for now. It's more fun talking sports, but let's talk about the election. Today is the primary day in Pennsylvania, Delaware, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Maryland. And I guess first, how maybe I could just ask you because I'm wondering, how did we get where we are today with the state of the primary campaigns?
Well, I think on the Republican side, one of the things is the more establishment faction, all the money went to Bush early on. And instead of going after Trump early, everybody just kind of felt he would go on his own, and of course he didn't. So they beat each other up, and Trump just came right up, and all of a sudden he has a plurality of delegates. Bush's problems were twofold. It was there was a Bush fatigue within the party,
yes.
And when you're running against the establishment, Bush is the establishment. And then Trump labeled him no energy, but the reality was he gives a fireside chat, the fire goes out. He's a good governance guy.
Right.
But in the dynamism that people were looking for this year, it just didn't cut it. So after he went, the establishment rotated. They were the Rubio for a while, and then they were, and at the end of the day, Trump and Cruz kept piling up the delegates.
Yeah.
And we are where we are today. And we've moved now into areas where Trump is pretty strong, and that's among whites in the Northeast. And I think we'll see that today in Pennsylvania and Delaware and Connecticut and Rhode Island and Maryland. I think you're going to see a big day for Trump. The problem for Trump is if this thing goes more than one ballot, I think he has a hard time getting nominated.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the underlying delegates, although they're technically pledged to Trump on the first ballot or sometimes the second or third ballot, once that pledge is over, they're going to leave him in droves. They're more party regulars. So it'll be an interesting convention, but just look, if Trump doesn't have it after one ballot, I think it moves us in another direction.
Well, and I guess there's this announcement where Cruz and Kasich are, I guess, working together, or they have a pact.
Well, they are, and I've been urging them. Look, I've talked to him and said, you guys, if you want to beat Trump, you're going to have to gang tackle him. Otherwise, Trump walks off with 40% of the vote, and he takes all the delegates in some of these winner-take-all states. So it looks like they've come together on Indiana, and Kasich's telling his folks, look, we need to stop Trump, number one, or there won't be a second ballot and third ballot, and
right.
I won't have a chance. And on the other hand, you've seen the Cruz people say, look, let's let Kasich handle Oregon, New Mexico. These are stronger states for him. And at the end of the day, it's in both of their interests to have this go to a second or third, certainly a second ballot. So they finally come to this strategy. But as you come into these winner-take-all states, and after this you have Nebraska as a winner-take-all state, you go to South Dakota, you got some states where you can lump delegates together if you win them all. They're more likely to be Cruz states than Trump states.
Right.
But look, Indiana is going to be the showdown at this point. If Trump wins Indiana, the math gets a lot tougher for everybody else to stop him on the first ballot.
And I guess just what's your sense of the Trump phenomena? I mean, what is it?
Well, it is a phenomenon. It is a phenomenon. And what you've had is you've got a lot of people that are just not happy with the direction of the country. They don't see the mainstream parties or the mainstream candidates or the incumbents really offering them anything. And along comes Donald Trump. And there is a strong emotional connection with him. His electorate is predominantly a white electorate. It's a very often non-college whites, but it includes a broader group than that. of people that are alienated. And it's many of these people have not been active in Republican politics before, but they see the cultural changes coming all around them. They've been economically, they haven't been advantaged over the last decade and a half. And they finally get somebody that's speaking their language. So it's easy to criticize Trump, but you need to understand what are driving people to Donald Trump at this point. And there's a resonance there that no other mainstream politician was giving him.
Yeah, well, that sounds to me exactly right. My family all lives in New Hampshire, and I was talking to them during the New Hampshire primary, and are talking to folks up there that I know, and the idea of building a wall was appealing to folks because of the cultural change and all those things, and just the feeling that
look, the color of America is changing around
absolutely,
them.
Absolutely,
at this point, you've got huge cultural changes now with gay marriage. You've got Black Lives Matter in cities. In a way, you take a look at disaffected whites and disaffected blacks, and they look at this very differently. The best congressional district performance wise for Obama was in the South Bronx, Joe Serrano's district. 97%.
Is that the one where Cruz went and did the event?
Right. Couldn't find any Republicans.
He brought them with him.
That's the poorest district in the country.
Okay.
The second poorest district gave over 70% of its vote to Romney, and that's in eastern Kentucky, Hal Rogers' district in eastern Kentucky.
Wow.
In both cases, you have people that are economically left behind that are watching changes all around them, and they're expressing that in different ways. So polarization continues at this point. The middle in America politics has been, it's been stretched for some times, and there is no middle anymore. And we see this expressed this year.
Yeah. Is there anything, we've talked or you've talked before about, your book, The Partisan Divide, and that divide and how it's manifested itself in the weakening of the parties and, each party moving more ideologically to, extreme, I guess, for lack of a better term. Does any of that partisan divide, it's not what Trump or maybe it is what Sanders and Trump represent to some extent, maybe more Sanders. I mean, is anything
Sanders
there?
Sanders probably more ideologically. It's hard to pin Trump down ideologically.
On anything, right?
Yeah. I mean, because it's a much more emotional attachment. But we've been into identity politics for a long, long time. And the Republicans have been gaining strength in rural areas. I have a map that talks about the counties that Bill Clinton carried in 1996 that Obama lost, even though Obama outpolled him. And you would think, the country would be moving in that direction. Well, rural areas have been moving against the Democrats now for 20 years. And Trump puts an exclamation point on that. A lot of this has been cultural issues. It's been coal. Once you take trade off, there's a complete identification with Trump, I think, in some of these areas of people finally speaking up for us.
Right. On the other side, on the Democratic side, I guess it's the race is sort of over in a certain sense, I guess. And just the Sanders phenomenon, it's not when you describe the two poorest districts, the African-American Bronx and, the
Appalachian,
Kentucky, white and black. Now, the white folks presumably are voting for Trump this time, based on what we see. But African Americans continue to support Hillary Clinton, and Sanders is a different, I guess, appeals to a different.
Yeah,
segment.
I mean, remember, and Sanders was arrested for civil rights demonstrations when he was in college, so his commitment to civil rights has been, longstanding. But he's just not as familiar as the Clintons are. The Clintons are a familiar brand name. I think they're. Some folks who they couldn't support her last time, they liked her, but Barack Obama came along. And so that's been very difficult for Sanders to break into that. But, I think Bernie Sanders is probably surprised at how well he's done in spite of this.
I think he probably is,
gone this far when he started out.
Probably Trump the same
way. Yeah, exactly. But you have an electorate at this point that is an unhappy electorate. They are concerned about where the country is going. They're anxious. Candidates have stepped up to the plate, and their voters have responded.
Right.
Not with policy. It's not policy. It's basically
it's emotion. It seems like. Yeah, absolutely, and anger. Tom, we do have to take our first break. When we come back, I'm going to ask you how this translates, and I guess it depends on who's running at the top of the tickets, what it means for Congress, and then we'll get into some discussions too about transition and what that all means.
Sure.
And some of the keys. My guest today is Tom Davis. He is the Director of Federal Government Affairs for Deloitte, and former congressman from the 11th District here in Virginia. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
This is an important time for the federal government, a chance for agencies to do things differently. How will you help shape your future? Turn to Deloitte. With our private sector insight and public sector experience, we'll help you rethink, reduce, and restructure, and turn resolve into results, so you can see what's possible and make it happen. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. Wherever you need to go, Deloitte sees you there.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Tom Davis. He's the Director of Federal Government Affairs for Deloitte and former congressman from the 11th District here in Virginia, out in around Vienna, where I'm from. And Tom, when we took the break, we were talking about presidential politics and just all the variations that we've seen this year. I've never seen anything quite like it. So where's it going and what do you see?
Well, let me start by saying national polls tell you one thing, but Republicans have a pretty narrow path to victory in the presidential race. And it goes right through Florida and Ohio, probably Virginia, not necessarily Virginia, but Ohio and Florida are essential to a Republican win. In the last presidential election that Obama won by 3.8% over Romney, only four states were within 5 points. And Florida, Ohio, Virginia, and then North Carolina, which Romney carried. Republicans carry those states. Then they just have to carry a New Hampshire or Colorado or something and add to that. And the electoral votes have fallen pretty neatly into line as you take a look at how they've been evolving over the last six elections. So look at Ohio. If you can't carry Ohio and you can't carry Florida and you're a Republican, you're not going to make it.
Right. It's, you know, it does that.
John Kasich, I'm sure, would love me saying that. Rubio and Bush did too, but I'm not sure where they are in this at this point.
Right. And what does it, from a tactical perspective or strategic perspective, what, I mean, obviously that means lots of resources in those states. How do the two parties, is that the point of attack? Do you try to find other places where you think you might do okay to draw resources away?
I mean, it's a 7 or 8 state presidential race for all practical purposes. In the last presidential election, 84% of the money was spent in 7 states on media. So it's pretty narrowly tailored because these states are kind of falling into line otherwise given the political coalitions that we have today. But it runs right through Virginia. Which means for those of us that are Bryce Harper and Nats fans in the World Series this year, we'll probably be seeing more of Hillary Clinton than Bryce Harper on TV because they're going to be running a series of advertisements to try to convince us to vote for the Democratic or the Republican ticket.
Well, you're optimistic this year, huh?
about the Nats. It's hard not to be optimistic about the Nats with a 14-4 start.
Just on the congressional side, where do you see that going? I mean, in terms of, you know, the Senate's more in play, obviously, with the numbers of Republicans that are up versus...
So Republicans have 54 seats, and you need 50 plus the vice president to control. My feeling is if the Democrats win the presidency, they're going to pick up at least 4 seats. Because when you take a look at where these seats are, they're in Democratic or purple territory. You've got Illinois, you've got Wisconsin, you've got Pennsylvania, you've got New Hampshire, you've got Florida... Iowa, although Grassley, I think, is a little stronger there than you'd find. But these are in North Carolina, which is very much a swing state. I think I said Ohio, but the bottom line is these are states that whoever wins the presidency is likely to win in these states and offer some coattails to that party's candidate.
And that does that, you know, you does that matter who's at? I mean, well, obviously it matters who on the top on the ticket, who's going to win. You know, on the House side, it's a much harder, you know, road to
get
to.
But remember this about the House: the way the lines are drawn, Republicans controlled more seats at the redistricting table in state legislatures, where most of these lines are drawn.
They had the state legislature more.
So the 2011 draw was a Republican draw. Just to illustrate this, in 2012, Democrats got more votes for the House of Representatives nationally than Republicans, but Republicans had a 17 seat lead. They have a 30-seat lead today. So it would take a little bit of a wave for Democrats to win the House, given the makeup of these districts. The fact is we had 20 districts, I think, that had over 80% of the vote cast for a presidential candidate. 19 of those were Democratic districts. Only one in North Texas was a Republican district. Democrats live on top of each other in these enclaves, and so their votes tend to be more concentrated, more compact in metro areas, where it's the lines necessarily give you huge margins. Right. Republicans live in more outlying areas where their margins aren't as big, but they control more seats. And you add to that the Voting Rights Act, which when you're packing minorities, you're packing Democrats, it bleaches the districts around it. End result is in the Deep South today, all you have are white Republicans and black Democrats. Blacks have more power but less influence than they did prior to that. And it has helped the Republicans control Congress. So it's advantage Republicans in the House, and it would take a fairly serious wave to take them out. Now, nothing's impossible. We don't see that coming at this point, but you got, you know, almost 6 months to go before the next election, and so anything can happen.
Right. So let's turn a little bit to, you know, what this election means for the federal government and, you know, in transition and that sort of thing. And, you know, you, as someone who's lived government for a lot of your career, mm-hmm. Just can you provide some context or perspective on, you know, I worked for the government for 20 years too and went through four different transitions. Mm-hmm. Just what does it, you know, what happens and sort of what are some of the big things that, that you need to pay attention to is whether it's going to be successful or not.
So I'm on the board of the Partnership for Public Service, which last week I did we had a meeting of all five of the standing candidates, Republican and Democrat for president, to go over transition rules. How do you run a transition? What are the rules? How do you get your appointees in line quickly? What are the things you need to be starting on now? And campaigns right now are focused on winning. They want to get nominated and they want to win. But laws have changed over the last 8 years that allow the taxpayers to start funding transition costs even before the election for the nominees of the two parties. And we were preaching to them, you need to get started now so you can have a government in place when you open up on January 20th. Usually, you're going to have half the government won't be filled by August because some of these people have to be confirmed by the Senate. That's a vetting process that has to go on. It's a long process. You're going to get inundated with resumes. And if you aren't organized and ready to go, it's going to take forever to get up and standing. And by that time, you've blown your mandate. All the goodwill is gone. Right. You know, the honeymoon period is a pretty short-lived period today. So we had lengthy discussions. The interesting thing I think that came across is I think all of them are looking at shared services as a way to start saving money. We know that the current federal budget can't sustain itself, that over time it's the airplane flying into the mountain. You know, something has to give. And it's been unpopular to raise taxes. It's been unpopular to cut programs. And usually when government wants to cut spending, they chop off fingers and toes.
Yes.
Really, the fat is labeled throughout in the way we do business. And shared services is one way where you can come in and save a lot of money between agencies, cut some of these legacy costs, get some duplication out of the way. So all of them, I think, are going to have a bar focusing on that in their transition. So I was encouraged in the discussions to be looking at that.
So do you say, just to take that another step forward, to me, in a certain sense, you're talking about a reorganization of government, perhaps?
Well, you'll get some reorganization, but you're going to have, look, whether it's payroll delivery systems, you know, whether it's how do you store data, all of these things right now, much of it is in silos. There's no reason these can't be combined in a manner that saves a lot of money and manpower over time. And look, we preached you can solve a lot of this just through attrition. You don't have to fire anybody, but you have a lot of senior people who are going to be retiring over the next 2, 3, 4 years. And you can take a look at some of those spots and maybe not eliminate those spots, but as people move into those higher spots, eliminate some of the jobs underneath them. But it's got to happen. Interest rates are not going to stay as low as they are. And when interest rates rise, the percent of debt that we're paying off is going to squeeze everything out of the budget. And governments have to be prepared for that.
Right. So, shared savings in my life is, you know, the General Services Administration, procurement operations and contracting. Is that something, do you see opportunities in that
area? There's a lot of opportunity to save money in contracting. The problem is everybody has a different idea over how you do it. And there are some that sound good. What's the old thing? Tastes good, looks good, tastes good. Some of them look good, but they don't really taste that good once you get into them. We're in a situation right now where they're taking low bid on some of these services, some of the tech stuff. And it's really, these are not commodities that you can just take the lowest. You know, you pay a price sometimes going a little lower on that. And you need to try to focus around best value.
Yes.
We still have way too many protests as you walk through through these. And part of that is we just don't have the people basically within government that understand procurement.
Yeah.
And we need to continue to pay people well who manage contracts, who are out there on the procurement line, making sure we get good answers up front. And you're competing with the private sector that pays much more in some of these areas.
Yeah, absolutely. And Tom, we have to take our next break. My guest today is Tom Davis. He is the Director of Federal Government Affairs for Deloitte, former congressman from the 11th District in Virginia. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion of some policy issues. I want to ask him a little bit about one of his favorite issues in the past, share and savings. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Brought to you by CGI, a global leader in IT, business process, and professional services. CGI partners with federal agencies to provide end-to-end solutions for defense, civilian, and intelligence missions in areas such as cybersecurity, cloud, and big data. Experience the commitment at cgi.com/usfederal.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Tom Davis. He's the Director of Federal Government Affairs for Deloitte, former congressman from the 11th District here in Virginia. And Tom, when we took the break, we were talking about a policy, doing some policy wonky kind of sort of things. And one of the things I did want to talk, you talked about, share and saving. Well, so share and savings, but just
you're talking about shared services.
Shared
but
services.
You were trying to, segue that into share and savings contracts.
Yes, exactly. There is leveraging in both areas. I think there's opportunities in the federal government, and I'd like to get your thoughts on share and savings.
Well, let's explain what a share and savings contract. It's a contractor comes in and takes a look at how the government is delivering a current service. They say we can save you a lot of money doing this. It could be let's take an easy way, tax collections. We say, you're leaving so much on the table. I'll tell you what, give us a share of what we can collect over and above what you would have written off, and you get money you wouldn't have gotten otherwise. I mean, we'll share in the savings. If we bring you efficiencies in delivering something, we will share in those savings. The beauty of a share in savings is the government doesn't pay if they don't get any value. How many procurements have gone in and you pay millions or hundreds of millions of dollars and get nothing, get no deliverables? Here, you not only have to have the deliverable, but you have to show that you get the savings and you share in that. And the expenses, the upfront expenses, aren't borne by the government. They're borne by the contractor. So you need pretty sharp contractors to make this work, because if sometimes they'll spend money and there's no savings and then they end up eating it.
Yep.
You need sophisticated people on the part of the government, too, to not pay off too much. There's a couple difficulties with this. Well, number one is the appropriators don't like it because they lose control of the process in a share and savings contract. You kind of, quote, turn it over to the bureaucrats who decide how to do this because they don't appropriate the money and lose control.
Right.
That's not always a bad thing, by the way. But from an appropriator's point of view, they tend to look at that as a bad thing. The second problem is that when the GSA, not GSA, but when the auditors come in afterwards, the GAO, and start looking at these programs in a share and savings, they're going to, in a successful program, they're going to invariably say, oh, if you'd done this on a cost basis, it wouldn't have cost as much. And that's invariably true. The problem is, in many of these cases, you wouldn't have done it at all, and you never would have had the savings. The key for the government is, how much do you net as a result of this? And I think as tremendous dollars can come into government through a share and savings contract. As you know, I wrote law earlier that allowed this, that's expired. But there's even if you put it into law, there's going to be a reluctance on the part of a lot of procurement officers to utilize this. It's new. You take a chance. Did we give away too much in the negotiations? We're just not good at that.
Right. It's to the risk-averse culture, procurement culture. And it seems to me, too, your point about the auditors looking at it, they look at the wrong things, or they focus on something that they can objectively sort of measure to a certain extent, and that is the cost, as opposed to the value and how you measure the efficiencies that you may have gained through that process.
Well, you know, auditors always come in. I work for an auditing company. We always come in and bayonet the wounded. I mean, that's just the way it works. So you never get a good audit. They always say, well, you should have done it this way. But you couldn't have done it the other way, because government never would have moved forward if they had to get it appropriated and take money out of their budgets and take that risk. So you're spending a certain amount for not taking risk.
And I want to go back to what you mentioned in the last segment, though, because it's a related sort of concept. And I share your concerns and observations. LPTA versus best value. You know, best value in a certain sense is a shared and saving type concept, in the sense that your goal is to get a better mousetrap that, you know, ultimately provides a better value to the customer, as opposed to LPTA, where you're only focusing on a objective cost number. And it seems
is low price technically acceptable for listeners.
Yeah. And it seems to me right now we're in a world that is an environment that's very LPTA, you know, that's price focused as the objective measure.
Well, it is, because the agencies are under a lot of scrutiny on their budgets. And so when you go out to procure something in a given fiscal year, if you can get a lower price for that, it doesn't come out of your budget. It allows you to spend your budget in other areas. Short term, it's a winner. Long term, it's a loser, because most of these technology contracts are basically not commodities.
Right.
They need to be. Sometimes you can take something off the shelf, but you still have to customize it. And sometimes the government doesn't know what it wants. They have a concept of what they want. And you go into an LPTA contract, and you end up getting something you didn't want.
Right. And performance you really didn't want. Yeah. But I think another, you touched on bid protest. I think that's another factor in moving towards low price technically acceptable. It's easier to evaluate an award than trying to do a best value.
Absolutely. But you know, I like the GWACs and the schedules, where you can go off and price it against two or three companies, and the government comes in. That you avoid, I think, in those cases, a lot of protests. Now, one of the problems is when the government goes out for a government-wide. Yeah. We call it a GWAX contract.
Yep.
Or a license to hunt, as we like to call it.
Absolutely.
That's where your protests come, because if you're not on the list and you don't have a hunting license, it's hard to get those contracts later, at least as a prime. And so that's where you see the protests, but you don't see them follow up on the individual items. And that's where the government saves its money. You can bid it against people on that list. And I think it's a lot more convenient for the procuring officers.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a factor there. The investment at the task order level is less. There's less inclination to protest. If you don't spend a huge amount of money having to chase something out of your B&P pool, you get a reasonable explanation as to why you didn't win, you're on to the next job.
Well, the other problem is, if you're on a list of bidders, you've made the cut. You have a license to hunt, but you protest a task order. You think you're going to get the next task order?
Well,
I mean, that's the reality of the situation.
Yeah, well, you hit on something there.
It's not in the law, but it's the way it works.
It's human nature.
Exactly.
Right, absolutely. So just real quickly, geez, we've already gone through last segment, I guess we'll talk about your book. But I wanted to ask you, too. I meant to ask you earlier about the budget and, you know, and how that what happens in the transition with the budget. When is that opportunity for incoming administration to truly affect the budget? I mean, isn't the last budget that proposed will be the current administration?
Well, in theory, the new administration will have a month or so to get a budget up and running. Yeah. And hopefully their OMB head will be on. And if they're doing this right, they'll be working this during the transition. They'll have a team on. They get up to 400 people during this time period that they can employ to work toward these. And once the election is over, from November 8th or whatever it is until January 20th, the incoming OMB personnel, at least to the extent you know who they are, can be working with the outgoing. And there is a permanent staff at OMB, as you know, that knows this stuff cold through different administrations. You can be on your way for a president to present their own budget. But, you know, what president's budget's ever enacted in whole cloth? You know, it's a talking, political documents. It sets your priorities. It's helpful to have it there. But they're always DOA when it comes to Congress, because the appropriators like to do their own thing. Now, in recent years, Congress's inability to get these appropriation bills out on time has given the executive branch a little more leverage and a little more power, as they keep these bills off the floor and you have fewer and fewer people actually involved in writing this. It really has strengthened the executive branch's hand. So if you're doing your transition correctly, you should be able to have a lot of say in that budget you present up front, because you're working on this even before the election.
Right. So just on a bigger picture question, and this is going far afield, a little bit far afield, but just, do you see any prospects? I mean, I know you've talked before, commented before about at some point, you know, you can do the shared services model and do a lot of things to reduce, but at some point, doesn't there have to be some sort of grand bargain between the parties and the branches? Is that something that do we need the crisis, the fundamental big crisis first, or is there any? Do you see any chance in the next four?
Well, the
years
good news
or so?
For American government is you know we do we're not Greece. When a crisis comes, we do come together to solve it. Sometimes we oversolve it, but right. we end up solving it. But without a crisis, nobody wants to move out of their corners. Everybody is comfortable with their own base constituencies. And it's been very difficult to get a lot of these appropriation bills out. I mean, the last time Congress passed all the appropriation bills on time for the October 1 fiscal year start date was 1996
right.
for FY97. And I was there. We only did it that year because we'd shut the government down to kind of twice the year before, and we're feeling guilty about it.
Yeah. I remember that.
I remember it too.
Right.
But so it's look, leadership can overcome a lot of other issues, and there's no sense of urgency by members of Congress or even presidents to feel this needs to be done on a timely manner. But think of it this way: if you have a fiscal year in a corporation, you don't know what your budget is for a year. How efficient are you going to be in spending that? And it's the same with the federal government. When an agency head doesn't know what their budget is for the year, they end up wasting a lot of money when the money comes in and not being able to plan appropriately and innovate appropriately.
Yeah. Well, Tom, we do have to take our next break. My guest today is Tom Davis. He's the Director of Federal Government Affairs for Deloitte, former congressman from the 11th District in Virginia. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about The Partisan Divide, Congress in Crisis, a book by Tom Davis, Martin Frost, and Richard Cohen. Just what that book's about. The title, I think, is pretty instructive and give us a sense of what the book observes about our current system and how maybe we could possibly address some of those issues. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The mission of government involves critical efforts to improve national defense, economic security, health services, and citizens' lives. The strategy and technology consultants of Booz Allen Hamilton are proud to help government address cyber threats, reform the financial system, modernize infrastructure, and protect our nation. For nearly 100 years, Booz Allen has partnered with clients to deliver results that endure. To see Booz Allen's ideas in action, visit BoozAllen.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Tom Davis, Director of Federal Government Affairs for Deloitte and former congressman from the 11th District here in Virginia. And Tom, this is a great book, The Partisan Divide, Congress in Crisis. It's yourself, Martin Frost, and Richard Cohen, co-authors of the book. And I want to share with the audience, this is a great book. But first, like, why write the book? What was the impetus for it? I'm sure there's a story behind that, too, with these guys.
Yeah, Martin Frost had been chairman of the Democratic Campaign Committee in the House, and I'd been chairman of the Republican Campaign Committee. And we got thrown together on talk shows, you know, he said, she said.
Yep.
And we start comparing notes, and we said, you know, we got to write a book. And everything you right now is it's on the right or it's on the left. You see it, you know, MSNBC will parade this as a book, or Fox will. Well, this is a kind of book, I wouldn't call it down the middle, because Martin will write things and I'll write a response. But it's a kind of a bipartisan perspective. And then Rich Cohen is the editor of the Almanac of American Politics. And, you know, has probably forgotten more about this than most of us know. And he kind of added a perspective, made sure the charts were right. And we charted out that the middle in American politics has just disappeared over the last 20 years. There is no middle in American politics now. There's no incentive to be in the middle. And we detail basically three macro factors that have led to this. First is the advent of these single-party districts. And that's a result of the Voting Rights Act. It's the result of what we call residential sorting patterns. It's the result of just strained gerrymandering.
Yep.
So that members worry about their primary elections, not their general elections. And primary voters are a thin ideological slice of the electoral pie, and they don't react well to compromise. They think they're right and the other side is wrong, and members feed off this. But there are two other factors. One is the media models are no longer what I would call balanced. They're no longer centered. They're no longer even vetted. Media models, and this started with the abolition of the Fairness Doctrine by the Federal Communications Commission. If you remember the old Equal Time or Fairness Doctrine, you showed a Ronald Reagan movie on TV, you had to give the other side equal time. And people started to say, this is ridiculous. So the Federal Communications Commission abolished that. And some smart radio heads said, well, we don't have to show both sides anymore. And talk radio started to come up. And catering to a certain group of like-minded people every day, tuning in and getting their fix. And it became a very successful business model. And was soon copied by cable news. Fox, and then MSNBC on the right and on the left. And finally, we see this on the internet now, where the crap to content ratio coming over the internet is just exceptionally high, because there's no vetting of this stuff. Anybody can say anything. And people are tuning in to websites that just feed them what they want to hear, and not having what they don't want to hear. So we call cognitive dissonance. They don't want to hear what they don't want to hear. The end result is you have a very polarized country with people, two different groups dealing with two different facts. And you couple that to these districts where it's all about the primary, that's combustible. But then on top of that, the third layer is campaign finance. When we passed McCain-Feingold, or Campaign Finance Reform Act, the theory was to get this soft money away from the political parties, that it was a corrupting influence. But I asked at the time, and so did Martin, well, where do you think this money's going to go if it doesn't go to the parties?
Yeah.
This money's going to find its way back in the system. It's called the law of unintended consequences. And it started to come back immediately in what was called 527s and some corporate speech. But two cases really put that on steroids. The first one is Citizens United, which has got a lot of people in a tizzy. But the case that really broke the camel's back was a case called Speech Now out of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. And that led to super PACs. And so now what's happened is the money, instead of going to the political parties, which have been a centering force in American politics for 200 years, the money's out on the wings. So look at it this way. The districts are no longer centered. They are left and right. The media is no longer centered. It's left and right as business models. And now the money is no longer centered. It's left and right. And voila, you have a polarized political environment.
So that's, do you have any, recommend?
We make a lot of recommendations. Some of them unlikely to be enacted. But I mean, like all of our problems, we talk about the deficit and energy problems and all these issues. They're all resolvable if people have the will to do it. We created these. We can solve them. The question is the political will to do it. Are politicians that benefit from the current gerrymandering likely to champion some other way of drawing districts? And the answer is probably not. Some states, through the initiative and referendum, have taken it on themselves to send these to independent commissions, and they've been successful in some cases of doing it, particularly in California, Washington State, Arizona, New Jersey. But it's just a handful of states. They've taken a look at runoff elections that the top two in the jungle primary will go on, and you could have two Republicans or two Democrats. Washington State had a congressional election last time with two Republicans, and so Democratic voters played a role in electing which Republican they wanted, and they took, unsurprisingly, the more moderate Republican. It's happened in California in some of these races as well, recently in a state Senate race, where had it just been a Democratic primary and a safe Democratic seat, it would have been a very left Democrat. Instead, it was Jerry Brown's former chief of staff who won the race, and he was more centered, particularly on the pension issues. So I think your laboratories of democracies in the states are already starting to take a look at something to do with that. Media is more complicated. Nobody really wants to interfere with free speech on that, but people should be aware that a lot of this stuff they take for news isn't news at all.
Right,
it's an entertainment model. It's a business model, and they're being fed what they want to hear.
I had a friend of mine tell me they'll watch MSNBC for a half hour, then they'll go over to Fox, and like maybe somewhere in between is
you got both sides in. Everybody's saying. There's probably a schizophrenic that was watching both the same night. But look, they're both valuable entertainment group. They have good people doing it, but the business model is not to give you a balanced view.
Right.
It's catered toward one side or the other, and that tends to polarize opinion. Which in some cases polarize the facts, because we can look at the same facts and we can have an honest debate over what you do with them. But nowadays, everybody's got their own facts.
Right. Well, and with regard to the parties, is there a prescription for reinvigorating the role of the parties?
So the Republicans, given the presidential race right now, look like they're pretty dysfunctional. But you have to remember, they are performing at a high, they're high since 1929. More state legislators are Republicans than since 1929. More members of the House than since 1929. More governors. So they're performing, they're kind of overperforming. And when you overperform, you have elements in your coalition that maybe wouldn't ordinarily be there. But the primary voters that have entered in this year have given kind of a a wrinkle that many hadn't anticipated in terms of the direction of the Republican nomination cycle. And it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. I mean, the fact that we're looking at a convention in July where Ted Cruz could be the establishment candidate just says a lot.
Right. Yeah, that's amazing. with regard to the last brokered convention was Ford Reagan.
Well, that wasn't even brokered. That was first ballot.
It was
Eisenhower in 52. Both Eisenhower in 52 and
thank you for correcting
Ford Reagan.
I knew you would.
Yeah, no, but they both came in and nobody had a majority going into the convention, but they were done the first ballot.
Yeah.
The last second ballot convention was 1948 for the Republicans.
Wow.
And so there's been really no need to change the rules through that time. Although when people start understanding them and how arcane they are and the fact that they're different in each of the 50 states, is it fair? Well, maybe it's not fair, but on the other hand, this is the way it's been, and everybody knew going in this was what they've done. There's been no need to change it. Democrats went through this in 1972 and nominated George McGovern. They said never again, so they added these superdelegates as kind of a softening force against somebody coming in from the left. And some Democrats like that, and some Democrats don't like that. Republicans don't have them.
Right. Well, you know, we got about a minute left. So from your perspective, if, you know, there's folks who talk about, well, you know, if it is a brokered convention or if there's a second or third ballot and, it will split the party on the Republican side. Mm-hmm. Do you see that happening, or do you see what are the implications
for
that? I
think there'll be hard feelings coming out of the convention no matter what happens.
Yeah.
They'll have 3 months to heal it. The unifying factor for Republicans will be Hillary Clinton on the other end, and it's really up to her to see if she can make herself marketable to disgruntled Republicans. If she doesn't make that sale, particularly with the Supreme Court on the line, you'll see a lot of Republicans close ranks. They may not be happy about it.
Right.
That's just generally what parties do. 1968, Hubert Humphrey had won no primaries, and he gets nominated over candidates that had been through the whole thing. And Democrats are in utter turmoil after the convention. And at the end, it was a very narrow victory.
Yeah, almost won. Yeah,
he almost won.
That, yeah.
So parties come together, despite the fact that it looks like right now you see Never Trump and all this kind of thing. But my gut is it's a very divided country, and we may not get the choices we want, but at the end of the day, this is pretty polarized. And I've just said Donald Trump right now polls the weakest among Republicans against Hillary Clinton, but he still carries probably 15 to 18 states on his worst night.
Yeah. Yeah. So it will probably come down to those, to Florida.
Florida and Ohio and Virginia. Look at those states. It'll tell you who's going to win.
Right. Well, thanks. Thanks, Tom.
No, my pleasure.
I do, again, want to recommend Tom's book, The Partisan Divide, Congress in Crisis, Tom Davis, Martin Frost, and Richard Cohen. A great read. Again, thank my guest today, Tom Davis. He's the Director of Federal Government Affairs for Deloitte, former congressman from the 11th District here in Virginia. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.